This is Unfortunate History.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Unfortunate History. This is a podcast where we discuss wacky, crazy, unfortunate events throughout time and the people involved with them. My name's Cody Pennington, and I'm here with my friend Greg Skinner.
Yep, that's me. Despite our different accents, we are actually living in the same city at the moment, so it's not like we're doing this from across the globe. Sorry to burst that
bubble. Crazy is that?
I know, an American living crazy in England. How does he get by?
It's ridiculous. But funny segue, actually, because we'll be talking about a guy from the UK today for our very first episode.
All right. Today we will be talking about Robert Liston, the mutton-chopped maverick.
Robert Liston was a prolific Scottish surgeon born at the end of the 1700s. And he was really world-renowned for his speed during surgery and a time before anesthesia, which is quite interesting.
I'll say this was a time when speed in surgery was so important, especially before anesthesia, because it was literally life or death for the patient due to, infection or the pain or any number of those things. But it does show how barbaric surgery has been forever, basically, up until only very recently, till like 100 years before this. People were going to their barbers to have any surgery done at all. Like, picture that. You go in like, oh, you're all right, Gary. I'll just have, a bit off the size, a shave. And, oh, can you cut off my rotting, festering leg with that rusty hacksaw with the last guy you did's blood still on it? That's what it was like 100 years before that. So in this time, this was seen as, like, advanced. So just to see how, like, in not a lot of time, medical history, like, medicine just goes on and on and on. And they actually had doctors, actual surgeons doing surgeries then, and it was still so barbaric.
Oh yeah, even now, some of the surgeries done today are incredibly barbaric. I don't know if you've ever seen a bone nail happen, but when I had my medical training done, I had to sit in on a surgery where they were literally. I mean, a bone nail is something that they use to if you break your leg, say the lower part of your leg, like a tib fib fracture, they have to stabilize it and put it back together. They drill a hole through the middle of the bones all the way down from the knee to the ankle, and then they hammer in a metal rod, a nail essentially, in through the leg, and they just literally sit there and hammer and hammer and hammer with blood going everywhere. It's absolutely insane. So I mean, it is incredibly barbaric, like you said.
See, this just sounds like when I was doing carpentry. All these medical procedures just sound like human carpentry or human plumbing.
Yeah, you can be a carpenter and a surgeon at the exact same time. Yeah, if you have the skills of a carpenter, you have the skills of a surgeon.
And back in those days, apparently a barber too. So literally cross-skilled.
Absolutely. Well, let's go ahead and jump into Robert Liston then. I'll start off with, I think the way we're going to do this episode is we're going to start off with a little introduction to Robert. We'll talk about surgery a little bit more in depth before anesthesia was invented. We'll go through a little bit of Robert's life, his professional life, and then I think we'll end on the main points. The main points we'll end on will be the unfortunate history, which will be a couple of surgeries that he did in his past, which all of them turned out to be truly unfortunate in some way, one way or another.
Nobody's perfect. So let's jump into old Rob's life.
Well, Robert Liston, like we said earlier, was a prolific Scottish surgeon and inventor, actually, born on the 28th of October, 1794, in Ecclesmachan, West Lothian, Scotland. Now, I don't know if we have Scottish listeners, but I know I said that wrong. So if you are a Scottish listener and you heard me say that wrong, please feel free to email us at info@unfortunatehistory.com and tell me how upset you are with me about it.
I would love to give him stick for this because he's American and us Brits love giving the Americans, hate for nothing. But I also have no idea how to say this name. So I'm not going to try. I'm going to let him take all the heat for this.
There's quite a bit of phlegm in these names, man. You know what I mean? Like, it's you can't always know how to pronounce all of them. But I'm doing my best, and I will do my best. But right now is a good point to say you probably shouldn't cite us in a university paper. We're not historians. We're trying our best. Now, Robert was the eldest son of Scottish minister and inventor as well, Henry Liston. Now, Henry is an incredibly interesting person, and we'll talk a little bit about him in just a second. But one thing that we need to mention, he's an inventor because he invented the either, it's spelled either way, I've seen it spelled either way in historical documents as the euharmonic or enharmonic organ. I think it's enharmonic, though.
See, I had to Google this big time, and I came away with more questions than I did answers. Like, I've had enough trouble working my way around my 50-pound keyboard that I've been trying to learn for the past 4 years. If you see a picture of this thing, I look at it and I get confused just looking at it, even Googling it, because I was getting enharmonic keyboard, euharmonic something, and honestly, this thing is kind of weird. I don't understand it just from looking at it, let alone any research, anything like that. God forbid I ever had to touch one.
Well, in relation to music, Henry was kind of a perfectionist, and he seemed like he was kind of one of the musicians that really loved musical theory. So this particular organ, I believe he invented specifically so that it could be played in perfect harmony. So, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I read that. That is absolutely right. But again, me being a bit of a doofus, I just looked at it and thought, that just reminds me of the octave setting on my incredibly cheap keyboard. But it is a lot more, again, it's a lot more fascinating to look at than that. The keys are all set out in like a stairway and they go up and they're all slightly along. But yeah, it's a confusing instrument.
I think we can just say that Henry was the inventor of the ancestor keytar. I think we can just go with that.
I'm happy to go with that.
Yeah, pretty much. But further to him being an inventor, because that will come back into play in Robert's life, a little bit further into his life. But Henry was also the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, which I don't know exactly what that is because I'm not a very religious person. But if names mean anything, it's basically just an assembly that all of the Church of Scotland churches come together and they just have a big meeting, probably talking about the issues throughout the year and that sort of thing.
So you're telling me this guy's dad was basically God's go-to for all things Scotland related? Like he's the area manager for this branch of Christianity. Like I just imagine him sat in an office cubicle somewhere getting douchey boss emails from God telling him his numbers are low for this quarter. That's what I picture when I heard that about Scotland and how he's the minister moderator for the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. That's what I pictured.
Yeah, that's pretty much, I mean, I could say that he was very important, pretty much, in the Church of Scotland. I mean, the moderator of the General Assembly, he didn't just do something once a year at this General Assembly. He also represented the Church of Scotland, events all around Scotland and the world. So he pretty much represented the Church of Scotland. And we kind of mentioned that, Henry Liston kind of mentioned this, diligence and hardworking nature, because that will play into Robert later on in the story as well, because Robert turned out to be almost a spitting image of his son, at least in his work ethic and his inventiveness.
Well, you would, wouldn't you? If you got, these are big shoes to fill, and this is a big shadow to live in for a young Robert. But it's got to be said, like I say, our boy Robert, he ain't no letdown.
He does some things. No, he's absolutely an incredible person, and I can't wait to get into his earlier life. But first, I think we should talk about surgery in general before the invention of anesthesia and how healthcare really wasn't that great in general for anybody that needed some sort of surgery or anything like that.
Sounds a lot like America now.
Hey, it's expensive. It's not that great. No, it's not.
Go NHS, come on.
So prior to the invention of anesthesia, surgeries were very similar to a horror film. I mean, every surgery was completed while the patient was fully awake and coherent. And I say coherent, but sometimes they would actually use alcohol, possibly as an anesthetic. But we didn't really do too much research into archaic forms of anesthesia because there really wasn't that many other than sort of like alcohol or drugs, opium possibly, and that sort of thing.
And honestly, even if that is the case, which it was, alcohol was used a lot in these times, but it was typically just a bottle of whiskey that was handed to you, and you got the choice whether to see it off. But let me tell you, I've been in some states, I have been incredibly pissed before, and I would know if someone started performing any kind of surgery on me. I think I would kind of be like, this don't feel right. I don't like this.
Get off my kidney! What the fuck are you doing? No, absolutely. No, see, but that's the thing. All of these surgeries were completed. Either you had this whiskey or alcohol or some sort of anything else to dull your senses, or you went through it completely coherent. And I mean, you can imagine any sort of surgery. Imagine, say, like most people had their tonsils removed. Imagine having your tonsils removed. I don't know if they did that back in those days. I should have probably looked that up as well. But imagine having it done and you're fully awake while this guy is literally hacking at your throat. I mean, that's what you're looking at. That's what you're dealing with. But if you can't necessarily imagine a specific surgery, we're going to read some accounts from some surgeries now, before the invention of anesthesia, so that you can get an idea of how terrible it really was. And both of these involved the removal of a bladder stone on each patient because we wanted to make you squirm as much as possible.
Now, see, before I read these accounts, I thought of like a bladder stone or a kidney stone. I've been like, you know, not that big a deal. Again, I've never had one, but they don't sound like the most gruesome of things to happen. Now, let me tell you, my opinion has firmly changed now.
Well, yeah, and actually, I mean, kidney stones and bladder stones are pretty much similar. It's just the kind of the difference is the location. They're both solidifications of, I can't remember what it was. It was like ketone or something like that. I'm not 100% sure, but they're solidifications that make a solid mass in either your kidney or your bladder. And we're going to talk, we'll talk about one. The first one we'll talk about is the bladder stone removal of a young boy. And I believe he was either 6 or 9. So we're going to talk about a researched account for this. And this is basically a pre-op, basically, but it's more like just before the surgery begins. And this is a researched account of this actual surgery. And it goes like this. Just before the commencement of the surgery to remove the bladder stone of a young boy, and despite having already inspected the child, the surgeon chose this dreadful moment to re-examine him. He inserted a metal sound through the child's urethra and into his bladder. Unfortunately, he couldn't feel the stone till after trying in all different directions and putting the boy in excruciating pain for several minutes. He at last satisfied himself, then gave the instrument into the hands of another surgeon for further testimony. This surgeon also had great difficulty finding the calculus, so he handed the sound to a third colleague. And according to a correspondent, these examinations occupied a full 20 minutes. During the whole time, the boy continued screaming and was nearly exhausted before the operation even commenced.
Oh my God. Listen, I had the misfortune of looking this procedure up. And again, in my readings, I didn't actually get any of like the scientific medical ideas, but people do this shit for fun and it's called sounding. They do this for a kick. You're right, babe, you're coming to bed tonight. God. yeah, get the rod out, you know, stick it in me.
I'll get my rod out, you grab yours.
Oh god, I'm open-minded. Oh, all right, but nothing's going down my urethra.
No, thank you. Well, if that didn't churn your stomach enough, we're going to do another one that's a researched account of a surgery performed on Samuel Pepys, who went on to be a famous person in history. I wasn't exactly sure what he did, and I'm sure some other people are probably screaming at me right now saying, he did this, but he also had a bladder stone removed during the 1600s, which is a bit previous to what we're talking about now, but it's an interesting account. And he actually celebrated the birthday of his bladder stone removal because he was so happy to get rid of it, which is absolutely crazy. It caused him that much pain that he was happy to get cut open. But this is Claire Tomlin's researched account of the actual surgery. So the surgeon got to work. First, he inserted a thin silver instrument through the penis into the bladder to help position the stone. That was the sound we were talking about earlier. Then he made the incision about 3 inches long and a finger's breadth from the line running between the scrotum and the anus and into the neck of the bladder, or just below it. And I think we all know that the line running between the scrotum and the anus is the gooch.
Oh, yeah.
Or scientifically known as the taint. So the patient's face was sponged as the incision was made because that does so much. The stone was sought, found, and grasped with pincers. The more speedily it could be got out, the better. Once out, the wound was not stitched. it was thought best to let it drain and close itself, but simply it was washed and covered with a dressing, and even kept open at first with a small roll of soft cloth known as a tent. It was dipped in egg white. A plaster of egg yolk, rose vinegar, and anointing oils were then applied.
See, that last bit sounded like the dressing I put on my lunch, except it's on somebody's gaping gooch hole. I won't look at that the same. But anything to do with that area of the body and the word pincer, the fact that there are pincers involved, that makes me cross my legs a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, now that you've got a firm grasp of what surgeries were kind of like before the invention of anesthesia, we're going to move on to Robert's early life. And actually, we couldn't really find much on Robert's early life because record keeping in the 1800s was kind of shit. So, I mean, we can't really find all that much about him as a child because it's not like today where you can track a child from birth till death and every movement that they make with a phone. So,
and it sounds like all eyes were on, you know, his dad. He was the main man in the family. So literally, yeah, there's very little about when he was young.
But yeah, I think throughout his early childhood, he was Henry's son. That's pretty much how he was known before he became his own man. Mm-hmm. But we do know that he was educated at the University of Edinburgh. And then following his education, he began his professional life at age 24 by becoming a member of the Royal College of Surgeons, both in London and Edinburgh. And he was actually the youngest person to reach that point at that time, which is an incredible accomplishment.
I was just thinking that, like, how was he doing this at the age of 24? I'm 27 and I'm struggling to do research for a podcast episode about fairly recent history, and that's with the internet. Like, imagine if I had to read a book for something.
I mean, well, to be fair, in this time, you think 24, in most cases, he probably would have been a grandfather in the 1800s. But still, I think 24 is still an incredible age to have reached this point as being a surgeon. Because I think even back then, you had to have an incredible amount of skill and schooling to become a surgeon.
Yeah, again, now, this wasn't like the barber times where anyone could just pick up a hacksaw or a knife and start lopping away at people. You did have to, like it says here, he's studying at universities and everything, the Royal College of Surgeons, both in London and Edinburgh. This guy knew what he was doing, definitely.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, during the time that he was, he became the a member at the Royal College of Surgeons, he was hired as an anatomy demonstrator at John Barclay's School in Edinburgh. Now, an anatomy demonstrator is someone, from what I can gather, and I believe it's still the same in this way that they're talking about it in the research as well as today, an anatomy demonstrator would be one that shows the body to medical students to tell them about to teach them about the body, basically, cutting open, dissecting the body, letting them kind of figure out what all the organs are, what they look like, and that sort of thing. And John Barclay himself was actually a famous anatomist. He was very famous. But what we find out in the research is that Robert kind of was sort of a dick to the people that he worked with. Or I think if we can compare it in a way, he just knew what he knew, and he was for sure not going to let anybody tell him he didn't know what he was talking about.
Again, Brian that big is not going to have anyone else's opinion. And he's, again, it's probably, again, part ego, part fully believing in what he can do himself. In his mind, he is the man. And I think when you think that way, even if you are or you aren't, people, you're going to come across like a bit of a dick regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the only difference between Robert is that most people would say, they disagree with their boss and say, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. I'm going to go find a job somewhere else. Well, Robert said, no, screw you, famous anatomist John Barclay. I'm going to start teaching anatomy and surgery myself, which he did. He went to the University of Edinburgh and said, I'm going to do this own class myself, and I'm going to teach students. And it actually became very successful. His first class had, I think, 16 to 30 students, something along those lines. And that was only, I think it might have been the same year as him becoming a member of the Royal College of Surgeons. So he quickly knew that I'm not going to send under anybody else's shadow, basically.
It sounds like people already knew who he was anyway. People have already turned up. Yeah, you know what I mean? He wasn't totally unknown. He was Yeah, he was getting there. He was getting there.
Well, yeah, I think he was getting there, but as a teacher, that's when he really gained his most impressive reputation, because he had an amazing amount of knowledge about the human body, and he became an amazingly knowledgeable surgical practitioner. Because at this time, he actually while teaching anatomy, he also started to accept surgeries from random people, because I guess you could most likely do that back then. But they would seek him out because they knew that he had so much knowledge, and he was so good at, he understood the human body, and he would take on ailments that other surgeons would just completely steer clear from.
This dude would have killed it in the social media age, might I add. Like, the first Craigslist surgeon, you know, surgeons seeking patients for literally anything that includes me cutting you open. Because he was just after anything. Like, it sounds like he was just after anyone with an ailment, no matter what class you came from. He would operate on you.
Yeah, and I think also that comes kind of, it could be hubris maybe, but he wanted to increase his skill in any way possible, and he knew that if he never turned away a patient, if a patient came to him, that was a chance for him to increase his skill, which I think is admirable. But the crazy thing is that everyone that he would accept, they usually were poor, underprivileged people, and he didn't really have an official connection to the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh, which I believe was the main surgical hospital in those days, and I believe it still is a main one. But he didn't have the official connection, so the surgeries for these poor and underprivileged people would be performed in their own homes or in lodgings that he would provide for them. And that kind of shows that he's really interested in helping the poor and the underprivileged. And I believe you found a bit of information which was really interesting that kind of relates to him helping poor and underprivileged people.
It does. Like, see, before I go into that, I was actually kind of conflicted with how I thought about this thing. Like, one part of me thought, like, he is, like, the kind of man trying to help those less fortunate with no money. But there was the other part of me that did think it's just an ego trip where he's trying to just push the boat out as much as he can. But yeah, doing a little dive through this, I did find out about that it was around this time that List and Story intertwines with that of infamous grave robbers turned murderers Hare and Burke over the body of Mary Patterson, of whom it is said Liston actually recognised. This led to a confrontation with a then medical colleague, Dr. Robert Knox, over the treatment of Mary, who it later transpired was indeed murdered by Burke and Hare.
This is actually really interesting, because this connects a crazy amount of connection. That is absolutely insane. But like you were saying, Robert Knox had her body basically given to, he had it himself, right? And it was absolutely insane. But this also, the story of Hare and Burke is really interesting. And if you want to know more about that, I suggest you look into the last podcast on the left's episode about Hare and Burke. It's really interesting, their story. It's pretty crazy what they did in that full year. I think it was 1828 or something like that, that they did 16 murders throughout that time. It was insane.
Oh yeah, those guys, their thing got out of hand. But yeah, back to this, like, Knox was thought complicit in the murder, and like she like Mary, she was in Knox's dissecting room within 4 hours of her death and kept in whiskey for 3 months before dissection, during which time she was essentially on voyeuristic display, just out there. Like, this Knox guy loved this corpse. He loved it a little too much, if you know what I mean. But like I say, according to Liston, he saw Mary Patterson's body in Knox's room and immediately suspected foul play. He knocked Knox down after an altercation in front of his students. Liston assumed some students had slept with her when she was alive, and that if they were to dissect her body, it would offend his sense of decency. He personally removed her body for burial. Now, there is a lot of conflicting reports on Mary and who she was. Some say she was a prostitute. Others say she was having a secret affair with one of Knox's students, to which she fell pregnant, probably explaining Liston's suspicions. But what is definitely known is that she was poor. She was from the lower classes, which lends to the fact Liston would have possibly ever recognised her.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. He could have been somebody that helped one of her family members, or her herself, maybe treated her for venereal disease of the time. Who knows? I don't know. But that's pretty interesting. It's crazy. And then also, like I said, like we said earlier, speaks to him and his personality of helping people that are underprivileged and really needing the help and the assistance, which is absolutely it's interesting to see through the research to find out what type of person he really was.
He definitely had morals. And if I do remember rightly, like that Dr. Robert Knox, he was actually, I think, charged with something through all of this as well. So,
wow.
Look, our boy Liston was kind of in the right with this one. He knew what he was going on about.
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like he was always on the right side of right until we get to the unfortunate history part of the thing, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But throughout those histories that he performed in the patients' homes and that, he began to develop a large amount of ingenuity. So he would improve on these operating techniques because he would be taking on the cases that other surgeons had said, no, we're not going to touch that. And he would improve on the techniques that they would try to use to assist these patients. He would make them suit the patients more. He basically stopped thinking as surgical operations, as surgical techniques, as a one-fit-all type of thing. He would create them and change them in a way that would fit other types of patients to better assist them, basically. And while he developed this ingenuity, there was a particular occurrence that happened during an amputation by a Dr. Andrew Russell. He was the professor of clinical surgery at Edinburgh. And I think that in this particular situation, Robert Liston was assisting him in this leg amputation. Mm-hmm. And an artery in the cut bone was bleeding so badly that they actually couldn't tie it in the normal way that they would. And Robert, being the ever quick thinker, actually grabbed his amputation knife, cut off a chip of wood from the operating table, and formed it into a cone and drove it into the bleeding orifice, immediately stopping the bleeding, which shows you exactly how ingenious the guy was.
He literally plugged the guy. But still, I fucking hate splinters, so I think I'd have taken bleeding to death over this. Because this made me go, oh, something going in like that. Wasn't a fan, but again, to even think of that off the top of your head, like, could you imagine a modern day surgeon doing that?
Like, no, I couldn't. I mean, that level of ingenuity is not, I don't think that's rarely seen today in surgical theaters, which is just shows you how important the guy was and how incredibly it's definitely ingenious, the things that he did. But while he was also developing this incredible level of ingenuity, this is when Robert really started to improve his surgical speed. And when I do believe he developed his famous catchphrase that he would utter before every single surgery, "Time me, gentlemen, time me."
Nice. Time me, gentlemen, time me. I really tried to work on my Scottish accent before this podcast. I tried so hard. And I haven't got the chops for it. I just don't.
I don't think I can do it. Mine would turn out like a bad Futurama accent or something. Like, I just couldn't do it. But like we said earlier, it seems kind of obvious, but the importance of speed during an amputation could never be understated. It not only did it decrease the blood loss of the patient and increase the likelihood of survival, but it also minimized how long the patient's pain would last. And like we said earlier, Robert was a really caring person in a way. He really cared about mm-hmm. people's their plights and stuff. And I can imagine that while seeing his patients in pain would really not sit well with him. And if he could try to lessen that pain in any way, he would have.
So on that note, although it didn't do that well back then, he was also one of the first to sort of push hygiene in the surgery. Is what something I read as well. Again, it wasn't taken seriously in the day, and he was kind of lauded for it at first, but he was one of the first people to take it before like councils and go, listen, we need to actually start, you know, cleaning our tools, just the basic things like that.
That's interesting. When Liston was 40, he basically developed all of these skills throughout all these surgeries and how he ramped up his ingenuity and his speed. Those years from the time he was 24 all the way up to the time he was 40 is when he was increasing his speed. But then when he would turn 40, he accepted an offer to become a surgeon of University College London, which is still a famous university in London. It's very highly regarded. Mm-hmm. Now, due to his amazing proficiency with his surgeries, he garnered the nickname "the fastest knife in the West End," which I think is just clever.
That's a good nickname to earn, isn't it?
I would kill somebody for that nickname. Literally, I would kill them very quickly for that nickname.
That would go straight on my Tinder profile, let me tell you.
Oh my God. Straight on your OnlyFans.
Definitely.
Now, Robert was so acclaimed for his skill and his speed that he became so well known for these facts that he never actually turned patients away, that his waiting rooms would often be packed with patients waiting for days at a time to be operated on, which I don't know about you, but waiting days to be operated on is not something I ever would have done. It's not like waiting for tickets to Coachella or something like that. You know what I mean? It's like you're waiting to be cut open or have something cut off of you.
See, that's what got me thinking, because I just pictured like how it is at a theme park. And then it got me thinking of a certain roller coaster at Alton Towers theme park. And it kind of got me thinking that roller coaster also chopped off people's legs. So there's a kind of a link there, I guess.
I can't wait. Now, he also had a staggering survival rate in comparison to the other surgeons at the time. Many of the surgeons had a mortality rate of 1 in 4, while Liston actually held a mortality rate of 1 in 10. Which he absolutely wore proudly. And it's actually pretty funny when you think about it, because the slower surgeons, they dealt with issues that Liston didn't have to deal with. They actually dealt with issues of the patients actually getting up from the operating tables and trying to escape the operating room, which that could have easily have contributed to the high mortality rates of their patients.
See, I just had this vision of them actually getting out, and I'd be like, well, at least they wouldn't be that hard to find, you know, just follow the trail of blood and organs, or just pull on the length of intestine it left behind and see how long it takes to get back. You know, like fishing, man fishing. That's what I visioned with this. But
now, as luck would have it, Robert was actually practicing medicine, surgery, directly adjacent to the invention of modern anesthesia. Now, on November 23rd, 1846, a Frederick Churchill, he was a butler, was admitted to the University College Hospital under Liston's care. And Liston found that Churchill had developed septic arthritis and he was going to lose his leg. Now, a recent discovery in America had shown that the dentists Morton and Jackson, which I have no idea who that is, but you might know who that is, you lucky listener, they had begun research on the use of ether in their dental practices. Effectively, that began the start of the anesthetic age. And Liston decided, since Churchill was going to lose his leg anyway, he would be the perfect guinea pig to attempt this anesthetic himself.
These are not the years to ever be a scientific guinea pig when it comes to surgery.
Now, on December 19th, Liston visited a Dr. William Squire, and this is funny because he basically heard this news fifth hand, and it could have not even been a real rumor, but Liston told William Squire that he had heard great news from America, which a Dr. Boot had received from a Dr. Bigelow in Boston. And the news was that on October 16th of the same year, an amputation had been carried out entirely painlessly under the influence of ether, which was vaporized on a sponge and inhaled from a glass vessel, which I think would mean that Americans invented the use of ether during surgery. So you're welcome.
Please don't do this, Cody.
Take that, NHS.
Don't do this, Cody.
I'm very supportive of the NHS.
Any kind of World War II episode we do on here, I am ready.
And we're going to go in.
I'm just going to let you go, and I'm going to think of ways to shoot it down.
I joke, but I completely support the NHS, and we need them at this trying time. We're during a global pandemic, and please stay home, listen to Unfortunate History, and make sure that you keep the NHS safe and in a state where they can comfortably do their jobs.
All right.
Now, Liston and Squire decided to attempt the American success on Churchill in 2 days. However, nicely enough, Squire felt like he would need to obtain a slight bit of experience on the use of ether as an inhalation anesthetic before attempting the actual amputation. So they decided to find a test subject who was in need of a tooth extraction, which went very well and to everybody's satisfaction. So they did end up going and planning the surgery for the following Monday. It's pretty interesting because William Squire, it seems like, became the first, in England at least, the first anesthetician, which is absolutely incredible. And I think, you know, maybe William Squire has a crazy background that we can go into, but it is really interesting to see how that kind of came together with Robert Liston.
Well, again, these things have to come from somewhere. Like, again, it does seem like this guy just sort of comes out of nowhere in this story. And again, he probably does have, probably does deserve a bit more than history gives him, if you know what I mean. Cause,
or a bit more than what we're giving him.
Well, again, I'd only heard of him because of Robert Liston and this story.
His face may be on the wall at an anesthetician's school in England, and we just don't know about it. So if you're an anesthetician and you're like, that's Sir William Squire, damn it, you need to give him his due. We're apologizing right now. We didn't
you
know.
Uncultured so swines. You look, that man is a god to me. His poster's on my wall. He's my Springsteen.
All right. Now, we're about to get into a detailed account of the first amputation performed in England under the use of an anesthetic. Now, on the afternoon of December 21st at 2 o'clock, Squire decided to carry out a preliminary trial of the anesthetic before they commenced the actual surgery on Frederick Churchill. So they decided to do kind of like a pre-show because the surgical theater was pretty packed for this particular surgery. And they decided to test the ether on one of these surgical theater porters, which I believe is just one of the people that brings patients in and out of the theaters from their beds to the theater and then back again, that sort of thing. And they did they used him as a subject trial. However, he was an incredibly large man, so they did not use enough ether to anesthetize him deeply enough, and he was able to escape the operating room screaming obscenities, which would have been an amazing sight to see.
That's got to say something too. If you ever, you know, don't want to be kidnapped, pack that white on.
Because yeah, exactly.
You will not go out. You won't.
That's a cheer for the fat people, yes.
Whoop, whoop.
Now, although that was a bit of a goof-em-up, the surgery still went ahead because they, Frederick Churchill was a butler, and I don't know about you, I've never seen a fat butler, so he obviously was small enough to receive the ether.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coming up is a detailed account, but I think we're going to kind of shave it down just a little bit because it's quite a bit lengthy, so yeah. I think we'll just kind of skim over it a bit just so you can get a good idea of it. But basically, the theater was completely packed. And it was packed with students and packed with onlookers because they had heard about this new invention that they're going to be using today. And of course, Robert Liston loved audiences. He loved applause and he loved to be a person in the limelight because he, again, knew his skill, knew what he knew, and he wanted people to listen to him and take him seriously. Mm-hmm. So it was completely packed. He walks in. They decide to address the onlookers, and Robert Liston says, "We are going to try Yankee Dodge today, gentlemen, for making men insensible."
Honestly, I thought that was a really cool way to kind of, you know, come out to an audience.
To be honest, it sounded like he didn't have much faith in it. So he's like, "We're going to try Yankee Dodge today, and we're just going to try." And Frederick Churchill's freaking out like, "You're going to cut my leg off." And he's just like, "Well, we're going to try it out. We'll see what happens."
See, we have very different, because I've read this and I just saw this, "We are going to try a Yankee Dodge today, gentlemen, for making men insensible." I saw some like, I thought this meant to be like a confidence-filled thing, but you've got this whole like, we're going to try it. I guess we'll never know.
I think I'm going off the fact that I don't think a lot of people have much faith in Americans, but maybe they did. I don't know. But you're listening to our podcast, so you got to have some faith in us, I suppose, or at least in me.
I'm the other 50%, so you can. It depends. I don't think Brits are faring too well in, you know, the general population's, you know, view on how countries are doing. So I think we're kind of in the same sinking ship at the moment, Cody.
Well, we mentioned earlier that Robert was also an inventor like his father. Now, during this surgery, and during a lot of his surgeries, actually, Robert would bring along with him straight amputating knives that he himself had invented. So he actually used his ingenuity and the improvement of all of his surgical skills. He also invented new tools to help him do them, which is absolutely incredible. That just that level of ingenuity just seems unheard of.
It's the kind of thing, it's not really taught. I feel like you've either got this or you don't. Like, it's not something that you learn anywhere. I feel like if you've got that sort of, you know, light bulb thing that goes off in your head where you're like, I can just make this myself and make it 10 times better. Again, that's just something you're born with, I think. And again, I suppose you could look at how his dad was with the whole crazy organ he invented. It must be maybe there is something to, you know, been having that sort of stuff genetically passed down, where you've just got,
or at least growing up with somebody with that level of skill. He had to have seen something along those lines to say, like, that, you know, I can imagine he wasn't stifled as a child in his ingenuity. It seems he obviously had a lot of skills, and he put them to good use. And his inventiveness is something that's absolutely incredible when you're inventing tools to help cut people's limbs off
in as quicker and least painful way possible.
Absolutely.
But now, people have been inventing things to cut people's limbs off since the dawn of time, but not in a surgical way where, you know, it can actually be, everything can be sewn back up, or if you know what I mean. It's just, it's a different level of thinking things through.
Absolutely. Now, before the surgery, Frederick Churchill did not want to have the surgery done. He was completely opposed to it and did not want to have his leg chopped off, which most people would be, but Liston believed he was going to lose his leg anyways, and if it was already becoming septic, so if he hadn't lost, if he didn't have the leg removed, he would die. So they went ahead with the surgery. Now, when they brought Frederick Churchill in, he was not necessarily happy that he was being brought in, but William Squire put the tube of ether in his mouth and held Churchill's nose, his nostrils closed, until he actually passed out on the stretcher that he was in. Or on the table, sorry. Mm-hmm. And after that, he basically gurgled, passed out, and they laid a cloth covered with the ether on top of his face so that he would stay under. And he was completely under. They decided to go ahead with the surgery then. And Liston turned towards the students, and he uttered that famous catchphrase that he was really well known for, "Time me, gentlemen, time me." Mm-hmm. Now, he grabs the leg, basically makes three or four quick cuts, creates a flap for the top, three or four another cuts, creates a flap for the bottom, takes the leg, it's thrown into a pail of sawdust, and he looks to William Squire, and William Squire tells him 28 seconds. Then a student yells out 27 seconds. Another student yells out 26 seconds. Another one says 25 seconds. And I think the accepted account was 28, because William Squire had said it. So within this time of the patient entering the room, Robert Liston basically made about six movements and had a leg completely removed in under 30 seconds. Now, they remove the handkerchief from Churchill's face, and he wakes up and starts completely denying the surgery. He doesn't want to have the surgery done. He says, "When are you going to begin? Take me back. Can't have it done." And then he's shown his stump, and he starts to weep, and the porters come in, bring him out. Now, since he left his actual hospital bed, 5 minutes had elapsed for the entire surgery.
That's crazy.
Absolutely.
That's a leg off in... I was trying to think of things that I think I could do in 28 seconds. And you know what? I struggled to think of many things I could do in 28 seconds, let alone remove a living person's leg. Now...
Setting up for a podcast. We can't set up for a podcast in 30 seconds. God knows.
Robert Liston would have finished his podcast 20 minutes ago. Let me... But listen, I've been under, I want to say, once in my life for a broken wrist. And it was weird for me because it did feel like blinking. Like you blink and then you're up again with a bit of everything's hazy. It didn't feel like you was out for a long time. So I'm trying to think of how this guy must have felt. Like, okay, legs there. It's almost like a quick blink, like a micro sleep. Up, I'm like, and leg's gone.
Yeah, but he went to bed. He went to bed fighting. He's like, "Get off me! Get out of here! No!" And then wakes up. He's like, "Ah!" Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's got to be the biggest mind fuck, because he's like, "Don't do this to me!" And then he passes out, and they did it to him. And then he wakes up, and it's done. I mean, that's absolutely insane.
It sounds like a really extreme, like, fraternity party hazing.
Let's cut off your leg.
Let's wait for this dude to pass out and cut off his leg.
Well, Robert turns to the audience after completing the surgery, and he stammers a bit and he hesitates, which makes me think that he didn't have faith in the ether. But he said, "This Yankee Dodge, gentlemen, beats Mesmerism hollow. And I think what he means by that, I'm not 100% sure, but I think hypnosis can be used in certain types of things to make people insensible, or it's used, hypnosis is actually used in smoking cessation. And I don't know if he's talking about that sort of mesmerism, but either way, he's basically saying that the ether worked incredibly well. Now, following this, Robert actually only lived for another year until he passed away at age 53 due to an aneurysm. So he actually lived up to the introduction of the anesthetic age and then passed away. And the entire world completely accepted anesthesia. There was zero people that had ever complained with the introduction of anesthesia. And they actually all, every doctor spoke incredibly highly of Robert Liston, which is actually very interesting and shows how much of an impact he had on the medical field and the surgical field.
See, I was when I was reading this about again how he did die in line with this whole thing, like, you know, becoming the norm. I did feel like it was a kind of like bittersweet moment. It was kind of like his body knew that he was becoming sort of redundant and called it quits. Because I do not think Robert Liston would have dealt with any sort of mediocrity. Like, I know he would have had his legacy with what he did. But I think as time would have gone on and he realised, like, oh, it's not all about being fast anymore. You will get these surgeons who are more precise, more this and that, the younger generation coming up. I don't think he would have taken that very well.
I'm not happy that he died, but I'm happy that he lived to the age that he was necessary in.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's bittersweet. Like, obviously, like what I'm trying to say is, like, I think it was almost right that he went at this moment, if you know what I mean. Like,
right, yeah, absolutely. Better than living through becoming obsolete, I suppose.
Exactly that. That's kind of the sign I'm getting at. For him, anyway. Yeah. I don't think he would have accepted any of it. Who knows? He might have gone on to become an even better surgeon with anesthesia. But, again, I think this was kind of a final bow out at the peak of his powers.
Absolutely. Well, he might have become a better surgeon, but as we're going to get into now, we're actually going to talk about some of the unfortunate things that happened in his past, which were not his best moments. Some are actually his best moments, but two of the surgeries were absolutely not his best moments, and we're going to get into those now. So that was Robert Liston's life, which I think is absolutely amazing. He's a fantastic person to history, and there's not much about him. So I hope that the listeners learned something from that. But now we're going to talk about three unfortunate surgeries that happened in his past. And the first one we'll go with was a young boy who had a tumor on his neck. So we did allude to this a bit earlier, but Liston, he was kind of a bit of a dick. But it was more like a, I know what I'm doing, and you're not going to tell me I don't know what I'm doing type of thing. Yeah. He knew how much skill he had. He was kind of, if I were to compare him to anybody, he seems like he's kind of a Jeff Bezos, but not as much of a dick. So, you know, I'm not 100% sure.
And also not as much of a billionaire, but...
Yeah, but Robert also knew, he knew when to operate, but he also knew when not to operate. So he didn't necessarily want to take someone into the surgical theater if the medical issue could be treated in a different way. And... Mm-hmm. He, in this particular instance, he was a bit too eager to operate on his patient. Now, one day, Robert was doing the rounds on his ward with his house surgeon, Mr. Bucknell, and he was shown a case of a young boy with swelling in his neck over the carotid artery. And most people would know this, but if you don't know it, it's the main artery that travels down both sides of your neck. There's two arteries that go down both sides of your neck. Now, Mr. Bucknell told Robert, the tumor pulsates and I can detect a bruit in it. And basically, this meant that Bucknell believed that the boy was suffering from an aneurysm, which is a weakening in the artery wall that creates a bulge. Now, Liston replied, and I think it's a very hilarious reply, but he replied, "Pooh! Who ever heard of an aneurysm in a boy so young? That's not a Scottish accent, I know, but that's as best I can do."
And I'll accept that. That wasn't as far. At least you went somewhat British. I'll take it. Somewhat. I'll take that accent.
Now, without any warning to anybody, Liston reached into his right waistcoat pocket, took out a knife, and made a deep incision into the tumor. Now, arterial blood leapt from the wound, and the boy fell. The artery was tied, but the boy died. And in the post-mortem, It showed that Liston was indeed incorrect. It was an aneurysm. He published the case, but did not admit that he was in error. And I think that might be due to his pompousness. And that, my friends, is truly unfortunate.
Oh, but how can he, possibly, how can he possibly not be in error for that? Like, yeah, I'm not in error, even though I was the one who pulled the knife out of my pocket and cut the tumor and very much cut through the artery. Like, I don't see how he had really much of a leg to stand on it.
It was his hospital.
His fault.
His hospital. He was Robert fucking Liston, you know what I mean?
Robert fucking Liston. These now, mutton chops don't lie.
Now, the second surgery we're going to get into caused a huge sensation for Robert. And it was in 1823, prior to Liston joining the University College London. A lot of people heard about this surgery, and I believe, since it was before him joining the University College London, this could have been completed in a patient's home or in a certain lodging that Robert had selected for the patient. Mm-hmm. Now, this operation was to remove an enormous tumor from a man's scrotum. Mm. Now, it wasn't necessarily, I believe it wasn't malignant, so it wasn't like a cancerous tumor, but it was a tumor in the nature of elephantitis. The tumor itself measured 42 inches in circumference, and it extended below the patient's knees. The patient actually had to cart the tumor around in a wheelbarrow. And I think this might have been the inspiration for the South Park episode where Randy gets testicular cancer and has to roll his testicles around in a wheelbarrow.
That is literally all I'm thinking of right now, especially when he said wheelbarrow.
Buffalo
as well.
Like, soldier!
This guy's life must have just sucked. Like,
I don't know, man. Well, we'll get to this in a second. But the account of the surgery said that the flow of blood, once the incision was made, it was likened unto the discharge of water from a shower bath. Ooh. And before half of the vessels could be tied, the patient actually fell off the table and just almost and looked completely dead. They gave him an incredibly strong whiskey, because obviously this was before the anesthetic surgery, mm-hmm. and they poured a pint of whiskey into his stomach before the end of the surgery. Now, after the removal, the tumor was said to have weighed 44 and a half pounds.
That is insane. How do you wear anything on the bottom half of you?
Well, I just mean, you know, what a testicle, right? Like,
that,
you know what I mean? Like,
that is a gonad and a half, my friend.
Well, the crazy thing is, 3 weeks later, the patient was able to walk out of the hospital and he survived. And so him dying wasn't the unfortunate part. I think the unfortunate part was that he couldn't show off his gigantic testicles anymore.
His gigantic sweet nut. God, he must have flown out of there. Like, he must have felt so light. Like, I bet he could jump so high now. God damn. He had a literal wrecking ball in his pants, but like,
knocking over small children. And
oh, mate. I heard like a tumor in your testicles. I thought, oh, it'll be a bit big. Not that big. That is insane. Imagine seeing that.
Absolutely insane. Now, the final surgery we're going to discuss about Robert Liston is his arguably most famous surgery. If you were to Google Robert Liston, this is probably the main thing that would show up about him, and it is very interesting. Now, in this particular instance, Liston was performing a leg amputation, and he had already developed his notoriety for amazing speed, and he was fully aware of this skill. So this was a bit later on in his career. Mm-hmm. Now, during this particular surgery, Liston decided that he would like to beat his own personal record and remove the leg in 2.5 minutes. Now, like we said, this is before anesthetics, the patients actually had to be held down by the porters. So he wanted to beat 2.5 minutes instead of, obviously, the 28 seconds he had with the anesthesia.
I say, like, I feel like this is kind of where his ego comes into play, because I feel like as a surgeon, yeah. I know he wanted to be quick, but I don't think you should be really going out of your way to beat you, just to do it to beat your record, if you know what I mean. Like, it fast, but not for the sake of just to beat your personal best time. So again, this does play into the fact that I think he was very egotistical.
So the surgery began quite normal. The patient was prepped, the surgery theater was set, and then they brought in an audience because he always generally had an audience. So once all of it was ready, Robert looked at his audience and he said his famous catchphrase, "Time me, gentlemen, time me." Now, Robert, likely more concentrated on the time than the surgery itself, brought his knife down so quickly that he was momentarily careless and managed to chop his assistant's fingers off along with the limb. However, as he removed the knife, he managed to accidentally cut the coattails of one of the spectators, who fainted and dropped to the floor. Now, as was quite normal in this time, infection was an obvious concern for all surgeries. Although you survived the surgery, there was no guarantee that you'd survive the infection that ensued afterward, if an infection ensued. Following this particular surgery, the patient unfortunately contracted gangrene and died. However, the assistant who lost their fingers also contracted gangrene and died. And finally, the spectator who had fainted when Liston cut his coattails had not just fainted. He had died of fright. And this particular surgery is the only known surgery in history with a 300% mortality rate.
And that was the first ever hat trick. talk about a combo. Like, this dude has got to be, that's statistically, you've got to be one of the most lethal dudes on the planet if you can take out three people with what? Two swishes? Or was it one? How many, cuts?
One. The way it's reported was one, was down and up, basically. Or two. Sorry. So if you were to say it's two motions, one action, maybe cutting off a limb, and then two movements to cut off the limb.
That has got to be the least effort to kill three people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's it, man. That's Robert Liston.
The guy is impressive, but he does have these unfortunate moments. But even the unfortunate moments, that 300% mortality rate, I'm somewhat impressed with how he's done that. He's like.
Oh, I'm incredibly impressed.
How'd you nonchalantly just kill three people? That's how a picture is like, dead. That's that.
Yeah. I can imagine he was just like, meh.
Yeah, like, literally that. That's what I
picture. Robert, you killed three people. Poo! You know?
Time me, gentlemen. Time me. Dead. Time me.
Jesus. Absolutely amazing. I mean, I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed learning about Robert Liston. He's a fantastic, interesting character throughout history. And I think, you know, it's he does have unfortunate moments, but I hope we were able to tell the listeners, you the listeners, that it was absolutely, he was also incredibly interesting around all of the unfortunate things that happened to him.
Definitely. And again, he was top of his game when he was doing it before anesthesia and all this stuff. He was top of the game for surgery. He's the man you'd want to see walking into your hospital room if you needed a surgery done in this time.
Absolutely.
But it did have, I suppose, in this field of surgery, there is going to be a certain level of unfortunate things that are going to happen. It probably happens to every surgeon ever. You're going to have little slip-em-ups, aren't you?
Yeah, we could probably have done an entire podcast on just unfortunate surgeries. And hey, that might be an additional thing we do if we ever start up like a Patreon or something. We might do additional things like unfortunate medical stuff or unfortunate Comic-Con events or something crazy like that. Who knows? You know, just something crazy.
I'm sure there's a few.
Now, thank you guys so much. I think that's really important to put out here. Thank you guys so much for listening if you're listening to this. And we do appreciate it. This was really fun. And we'll be continuing doing this for the foreseeable future. We're going to try to do at least one episode a week because we have a lot of stuff already set up.
We
have a lot of really cool topics that we're going to cover. And I think it'll be great to just keep this going because I'm learning so much from these people or these events and stuff that we're covering. It's really interesting. And if you want to keep up with us, you can follow us on Facebook. We have a Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the show. If you want to look up Facebook, it's facebook.com/unfortunatehistory or Instagram at Unfortunate History. You can also join our Facebook group. So if you search on Facebook the Unfortunate History podcast group, you can join that. That'll probably be a better way to get in touch with us on social media. And then if you want to follow us on Twitter, it is at UnHistoryPod because there's a 15 character limit on Twitter and it's absolutely fucking annoying. If you want to talk to us or make any requests, you can get in touch with us at info@unfortunatehistory.com. And we look forward to getting in touch with you guys. And for me, Cody Pennington, you can find me. You can, if you want to just Google me, you can find all of my social media if you Google Cody Pennington. And Greg, do you want to tell anybody?
It's the exact same for me. Just look up Greg Skinner on Facebook or Instagram and you'll find me. But yeah, this has been fun, man. Like, anyone who listens, thank you. And keep tuning in, man, because like I say, this is learning for us as well. Like, we're picking it up as we go along as we're doing it.
We are, so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hope this is good quality and I hope the recordings don't fuck up and we have to do this all over again, but I have enjoyed it with you. I will say that.
Oh, yeah, at the very least, we've got some good quality friendship time out of this.
That's the important thing, you know? That's the important thing.
But if we have to do this again, my head will explode.
That would be truly unfortunate.
Not the podcast, but if I have to go through the whole Robert Liston thing again, goddamn. Because we're going to do this again next week, but hopefully on a new topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're still working on sign-offs, but yeah, I guess I don't know what it is. I mean, we could probably just say, tell everybody out there to stay unfortunate.
Oh, yeah. Well, stay unfortunate.
Yeah.
Well,
in this trying time,
with everything that's going on, we hope you stay fortunate for now. But in the long run, stay unfortunate.
Hell yeah. See you, everybody. Bye.
Ta-ra. Bye-bye-bye.